Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, May 28th. I'm Dave Rabin. It's great to be with you. It's great to be back in studio looking at the shining face of our wonderful engineer, Mike Nasella. Later in the show, an interview with the director of a theatrical double bill that looks at how women of color rise to power and what gets sacrificed in the name of progress. And we'll speak with the public historian Sarah Schoenfeld about redlining in D.C. and nationwide. That's a really important interview. Both interviews are really important. The redlining one, there's an exhibit at the Cleveland Park Library that is extremely important and insightful about what's going on currently and what happened in the past that led to this horrific redlining phenomena. But first, a moment of silence for the people of Gaza, Sudan, Ukraine, and Papua New Guinea, and there are other places as well, but why don't we start with that? A moment of silence, please. You know, we lead our daily lives and with challenges and struggles, but it's all relative, folks. Thinking of people out there enduring extraordinary suffering. On with our fundraising, as you might have noticed, last couple of weeks we are in fundraising mode. We need your support. We are offering, I think, an invaluable service to the D.C. community. Look at our show today. We're talking about a very important play right here in D.C., important to folks here, important to folks everywhere. And then we're going to talk about redlining both here in the district and nationally. I think it's really relevant, important radio. It's a community service. We're building Jazz and Justice one broadcast at a time. So please step up. We need you to show the love, show the support. The number to call is 202-588-9739. You can also go online, wpfwfm.org. There's a PayPal option that you'll find on the website if you want to do it that way. Checks are also more than welcome. I don't have the address right in front of me. You can get that online at our website. We have a $600 goal. We need you to step up, show the love. My beloved co-host, I believe, is with me. Are you there, Ray? Maybe not.
Somebody's echoing as well. Are you muted, Dave?
Am I muted? I am not.
I am not muted. I hope people are hearing me. Are they, in fact?
Yes, mute them so because we're getting an echo. Mute the phone microphone, please.
I should mute the microphone?
Yes, we're using the microphone in the studio, not in the room.
Oh, right. And I believe that I've got my computer mic'd, I believe. Let me see if there's anything
I can do about that. We got a little echo here, huh? Tech. Go ahead and work it. Okay. So we are asking for your support. I'm hearing feedback. I'm delayed. Huh. Oh, the wonders of modern tech. Technology. Maybe I'll just deal with the feedback. I don't think I have much choice.
And I think he just pulled the trigger, and I think we are good to go and could really use your support, folks. Please step up. Once again, WPFWFM.org or 202-588-97. Please show the love, not so much for this show, but for the beloved community resource that is WPFWFM, listener-sponsored radio in the nation's capital. And on to our wonderful first guest. There's a theatrical double bill opening soon in D.C. that looks at how women of color rise to power and what gets sacrificed in the name of progress. The world premiere of Letters to Kamala, a Dandelion piece by Yale Prize-winning playwright Rachel Lynette, presents two alternative visions of politics, one serious, the other comedic. Presented by Voices Festival Productions, the plays run June 8th through June 30th. At Universalist National Memorial Church in D.C., just east of DuPont Circle. We're joined now by the play's director, Lorraine Robinson. Lorraine Robinson, welcome to Community Watch and Comment. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much, David. It's great to be here with you.
Thank you very much for being with us. So, a serious and comedic take on how women of color rise to power and what gets sacrificed in the name of progress. Wasn't there a Woody Allen movie back in the day, Melinda? There's got these four, I think, movie producers or playwrights sitting around talking about a story. Well, is this a tragedy or is this a comedy? It sounds like it's looking back at that. You're probably too young to remember that movie.
Well, you know, I love that we're doing this double bill of two plays, and you know, I think the question of is this a drama or a comedy, or you know, what are we left with at the end? I think those questions are left for us, I think folks are in for a real ride.
A real ride, absolutely.
Super important history lesson, very recent history, but of just these trailblazing historic women political leaders of color, three ancestral women, Charlotta Bass, the first Black woman candidate for vice president in the United States, Darlene Mitchell, the first Black woman to run for president of the U.S., and Patsy Matsutak Modo Mink, the first woman of color to be elected to the House of Representatives and co-author sponsor of the Title IX law for gender equality in sports. These three women leader ancestors come and they are giving their advice to Kamala Harris. The play is set on the eve of the last election in 2020 when things were hanging in the balance. And we get to hear their sage advice in that piece.
And how did the play actually come into being? I mean, it's a wonderful story that I think people would enjoy hearing about.
Sure. Sure. I'm glad that you asked that. Letters to Kamala was originally commissioned by another theater company. They commissioned Rachel Lynette during the pandemic. So this piece has only been performed previously online on Zoom. And so we are excited to be bringing a full-bodied production to it now in D.C. But it was established at that time. And then we wanted to, since that was written in 2020, we wanted to, you know, sort of have a response and update to, you know, our current political moment. And so we commissioned Dandelion Peace as a companion to Letters to Kamala. And the second play is a beautiful farce, a political farce. It's also about politics. It features the same wonderful women actors that will perform in Dandelion Peace. It features them as members of a DC community garden. And it's really all, although it's about plants, it's really all about politics and kind of our current political system. So we get a real, a different scope of information. You know, what I like about the two pieces are that, you know, the first piece kind of is about our macro politics at large. A lot of the same questions for Kamala Harris sort of hang in the balance as they did right before the 2020 election. I mean, it's really interesting how in a lot of ways it feels like we're in a sense of deja vu in the same place. The second play, I think, really speaks to our local community politics and the ways in which our bitter national divides have kind of trickled down and infused our relationships with our neighbors and our personal choices. And we get to see how those sort of arguments play out in a political farce amongst these characters in the D.C. community garden.
So interesting. Just focusing on the first play, I believe I noticed that Kamala Harris does not actually, if I'm correct, have a character in the play. She's being spoken to, but she doesn't actually appear.
Yes, she is we'll see. You'll have to come and see. But she is a figure in really these women, these historic leaders, these ancestors have been summoned for her, for their sage advice, and we get to learn about them. So you'll have to come and see if Kamala makes an appearance or not. But the play is focused on these fascinating leaders. And it's just important to know that, you know, there is not just one, but that there are a history of strong, groundbreaking women leaders that have really paved the way for Kamala's vice presidency to have been possible.
Right. As they say, she's standing on the shoulders of people that came before. And I believe Ari Roth of Voices Festival Productions was like reading the script and said, these three women from history, women of color, are just amazing. And I never heard of any of them.
I've heard of,
I'm old enough to have heard of Patsy Mink. I mean, she was actually in the House of Representatives, but I hadn't heard of the two African-American women.
Exactly. You know, I'm the same for me. I'm familiar with Patsy Mink, but shamefully, you know, I was not familiar with Charlotta Bass and Charlene Mitchell. And, you know, when I read the script and we selected it, you know, I just felt like, oh my goodness, why don't I already know more about these women? And I think we certainly knew if we felt this way, many others would feel the same. And obviously, these are stories and histories, recent histories, but that we all need to be remembering and revisiting and to take inspirations from.
Right, right. And then Ari Roth, who we've been on this program excuse me, several times with Theater J and Mosaic Theater. I mean, he is an institution, I think we can say, here in D.C. And then he wanted a more complete evening besides Letters to Kamala. Did he know he was going to get a comedy out of our esteemed playwright?
We knew we were going to get a companion piece. We knew it was going to be an allegory set in a modern community garden. We knew it was going to be about politics, but through plants. And that was what our playwright pitched to us. And we were absolutely entranced with the idea, especially, you know, having some familiarity ourselves in different ways through different family members and their connections to community gardens, and how serious the gardeners take all of their rules and strictures and requirements. And our playwright herself, in the interview, I believe we is out in some publications and in our upcoming program bill, but talks about her experiences in community gardens too, and just what a little mini society they are, and how she knew that that would be a great jumping off point for her play, and as a reference for kind of our communal relations in this time of sort of great national divide.
I mean, you think of community gardens being something, a collective effort where people are working in harmony. I have one right near me. I bring compost over there. But, you know, this is a fertile ground, no pun intended, or maybe pun intended, for political metaphor. And there's a dandelion infestion and that set things off. And then there's a campaign for the presidency of the community garden. I mean, it just sounds really wonderful.
It is, and it's so relevant. And also, it's so wonderfully funny. I have to say that this company of actors that we have, these women actors, they are phenomenal. They're all Equity members, and they are at the top of their games. And they are going to bring something special to the audiences. I strongly encourage folks to come and see their amazing performances.
So is it difficult to, you start off with a very serious initial play, these three women visiting Kamala Harris. Is it difficult switching gears for you, for the actors involved?
Well, there will be a brief intermission where we change the set. So they'll have a few minutes to do their transition and transformation. But it's actually a wonderful, I think, relief to shift gears midway in this way from, you know, tone and style. And, you know, we learn so much and we identify and connect so much with the amazing work that these women do, these real life figures, political leaders in the first play, Letters to Kamala. And then in the second one, it's like a release. And we experience these fictional characters that could be, you know, people that we know, our next door neighbors. And we get to, I think, as a group in the audience, really meditate on us, our society, and sort of where we are, and just think about what are the choices we're making? You know, what are the actions we're choosing to make? How are we choosing to interact with our neighbors? And how we treat them and interact with them. And so it's just all the questions of really, again, political society right now are right there for us, but it's done in a really fun and refreshing way. And I think the audience will enjoy the switch, the transition, the shifting of gears very, very much.
Just in closing, tell us a little bit about Voices Festival Productions, relatively new, but doing really innovative, important, fascinating work.
Oh, yes. Voices Festival Productions, we are just about 2.5 years old, so still brand new This is our first full-fledged production with an incredible set by our set designers. We have a beautiful team of designers. Voices Festival Productions is looking forward to really greeting all of us with these two shows.
Wonderful. It's fascinating. We're really looking forward to it. It's opening June 8th, running through the 30th of June at the Universalist National Memorial Church. What is it, 1810 16th
Street? 1810 16th Street Northwest. And just to let everyone know a little bit more about Voices, you know, we are an independent production company. We're based in D.C. The plays share our underlying humanity in all its color and complexity, finding resonance between those living with conflict in the Middle East and closer to home in our nation's capital. Along the scenes of our nation, it's very real and perceived divides. And we celebrate diverse intercultural voices and encounters through interconnected performance of both provocative and introspective new works for the stage in dialogue with our moment. And I think these two plays, Letters to Kamala and Dandelion Peace, you will see that perfectly represented there.
Wonderful. Is there a website people should check out if they want to get tickets and schedules and such?
Yes, please visit our website, www.voicesfestivalproductions.com for tickets and more information about the shows and all of the wonderful artists that are connected with it.
Thank you so much for being with us. I'm speaking with Lorraine Robinson, director of the world premiere of Letters to Kamala and Dandelion Peace, a double bill presented by Voices Festival Productions, runs June 8th through the 30th at Universalist National Memorial Church. Thank you so much for being with us, Ms. Robinson.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. And you are listening to Community Watch and Comment on the community resource that is WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time. And as you very well know, if you're listening to the station, we are in fundraising mode. Most definitely, we need you to step up and show the love. We are trying to get out of our current location this summer, and so we are in particular need of your support. It takes the do-re-mi. It's a big operation, equipment and whatnot to move to a new location. And we really always need your support. We are listener-sponsored. We are operating on a different model. We are not inundating you with commercials. I listen to commercial radio occasionally, and I can't believe, you know, how people put up with, you know, buy this, don't wait, buy now. And we're not doing that, but we do occasionally need to come to you and ask for your support. 202-588-9739. You can go online, wpfwfm.org. We have a PayPal option at that site. We have a $600 goal. We haven't scratched it yet, folks. Please show the love. Please step up. Make the call that makes a difference to WPFW. And I'm joined by my esteemed and lovely colleague, Ray Valencia. What do you think, Ray?
Hi, so nice to join you. And yes, you know, it's community-based radio. We are the community. We need to participate in this beautiful station that's bringing news to you that you're not hearing on mainstream media, right? We had Ralph Nader on last week. We've talked to Professor Kuznick about world affairs. You're talking to local theater directors about what's happening in the community. So we build the station together, and we need your support. And I know what it's like being a listener, and you want to be a part of it, and you know you want to do it, and you just haven't yet. Well, now is the time, right? We have a $600 goal. We understand that, look, there is inflation in the economy. We all hear the news, but we all feeling it. I hear you. So become a sustainer. It would be your donation over installments over the course of the year. and it wouldn't take as much of a bite on a monthly basis. And we would really appreciate your support. And we love the work that we do. It's largely volunteer driven. We're journalists that really want to bring a perspective on the news that you may not be enjoying and benefiting from other areas. We bring great music, a platform of jazz and justice, and we need you right now. So please come online at WPFWFM.org, or you can call the station at, what's the number, David? 888?
What is it? I think simply just give out the 202-588-9739. With all the cell phones out there, it doesn't make any difference where you are.
800-222-9739.
Yeah, you don't
please
need the 800, just 202-588-9739. And sustainers are always welcome, whatever you can give. Give your weekly a latte would be just fine. Just give us your credit card, your debit card, and you can always end it if need be. Sustainers are strongly encouraged. But for $50, you can get a pair of tickets to the plays that we just were speaking with the producer, the director of, Letters to Camilla and Dandelion Peace, or for $50, you can get a Taste of Shaw Food and History Tour, and that will be, your guy will be our own Ray Valencia.
Yes, and, absolutely.
And for $75, we can put together a package. We've got a couple of these packages for $75. You can get both the play tickets, a pair of tickets, and a pair of tickets to a Taste of Shaw Food and History Tour. And we are going to get on to our next guest. You've heard enough pitching. it just comes with the territory. We are listener-sponsored. We need to come to you for your support. So please show the love. Please make the call or go online and make the donation that makes a difference to the wonderful resource that is our beloved WPFW. On to our next wonderful guest. There's a compelling exhibit at the Cleveland Park Library in D.C. running now until July 11th. Undesigned, the Red Line explains the history of redlining and other once legal policies that denied Black residents and other people of color access to home ownership in Upper Northwest D.C. and nationwide. We're joined now by D.C. historian Sarah Schoenfeld, who contributed to the exhibit. Ms. Schoenfeld is the co-founder of Mapping Segregation in Washington, D.C., and of the D.C. Legacy Project. Sarah Schoenfeld, so glad to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me today. I'm really happy to be here.
Really great to have you. Let's start with just a basic definition of redlining. And believe it or not, there might be people that are not familiar with it, particularly young people that, they're experiencing the effects of it, that might not have a handle on the actual term. If you could give us a rundown on what it started back, ironically, in Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, which had, a lot of appeal, was trying to help underserved people in the middle of the Great Depression, but it had its dark side.
That's right, yeah. So redlining, first of all, it's the origins of its name, redlining, are in maps that were made by the federal government in the 1930s by a federal government agency that was created during the Roosevelt administration to begin underwriting mortgage loans to enable people to stay in their houses or buy new houses. And also to really give a boost to the building industry. So the maps that were made sort of outlined areas that may be worthy of investing in based on who lived in those areas, not only who lived in those areas, but other, you know, other features. But certainly they took into account the existing population of different parts of cities and the outskirts of cities and areas where people of color lived or lived near to were almost always colored red on these maps. So the maps had, you know, about four different colors. Red was the color that was defined as hazardous. Hazardous for investment. And so you had areas, because these patterns of segregation had already been kind of in place by the time these maps were created in the 1930s, you had areas that were predominantly populations of people of color, whether people of African descent or of Mexican people, sometimes Native American, Chinese people. It depended where you were in the country. But always places where people of African descent were living or living very close to were going to be colored red on those maps. And that's where we get the term redlining, and which refers to discriminatory investment. So the refusal of not only the government to underwrite mortgage loans in those areas, but then banks, you know, the refusal of banks and insurers to make loans at all. So you have people living in, you know, including homeowners that are unable then to get loans to make improvements to their homes. You have people wanting to maybe move into those neighborhoods or to build new housing that can't get loans to build. So that leads to the degradation and that sort of deterioration of those neighborhoods due to lack of investment. I mean, physical deterioration of a lot of the building stock, certainly. And sort of lack of infrastructure investment over time. So that's where redlining sort of began and how it evolved.
Right. You know, and people often think that it's initiated by the banks, but the banks, the insurers are kind of following suit from the government. And I guess it's one of the more astounding things I've learned doing this show is just the underlying racism of the New Deal. I mean, when you look at what Social Security, you know, domestic workers and agricultural workers are excluded. Well, guess what, folks? Who is comprising those two categories? People of color, and you know, the New Deal was a Southern Democratic based. A party, FDR wasn't, you know, he's a New Yorker, but he's dealing with a party that's Southern-based and deeply racist, and we're dealing with the Great Depression and people getting foreclosed on. The government, understandably, and it was a good thing to step up and try and provide some kind of a system for federally insured home mortgages, but people of color are not able to access it. I mean, it's an extraordinary, tragic moment, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, ultimately, only just over 2% of all of the loans that were made by the Federal Housing Administration and the Veterans Administration via the GI Bill were made to African Americans.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, and of course, so you've got these inner cities where people of color live and they can't get mortgages. But, of course, speculators can get mortgages, and they go in buying up houses and renting out to largely people of color at elevated rents. I mean, it's a disastrous situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. I mean, and this is when you talk about structural racism, this is what we're talking about.
Yeah, and certainly, yeah. I mean, so there it's very much with us today, and it comes, and the history of it maybe is longer than many people realize. And so, I mean, these maps go back to the 1930s. But as I said, like the maps kind of baked into place, as, you know, patterns that existed. in that, you know, segregated communities already existed. And these were, this was largely due to the use of racially restrictive deed covenants, which came about, you know, earlier in the 20th century. Well, really the earliest, I mean, they came about before the 20th century, but they became much more widely used, you know, in the first couple decades of the 20th century. And these were, you know, restricting entire new subdivisions to whites only. So you had the evolution of these white, exclusively white neighborhoods, that then by the time these maps are made, which is then pushing people who, you know, people who are not white, who maybe have lived in these places, out of these areas. And this is something that we go into in the Undesigned DC exhibit. So then by the time these maps are made, you've got this, you know, highly segregated city that didn't necessarily look that way, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century.
Right. Right.
But this is something, the Undesigned DC is, so Undesigned the Red Line is an exhibit that has been exhibited in other cities, but here in DC, a community advisory group was convened to really try to make the content really relevant locally. So it's not just about federal policy and how that impacted people, you know, all over the country, but how very specific things that happened here. And so one of the things that this exhibit really goes into, and because it's also really focused, it was created by a group of congregations in Ward 3, and I'll say is really hoping to reach a lot of people that live in Ward 3. It's at the Cleveland Park Library, as I think you mentioned. It talks about some of the Black communities that lived in the Tenleytown area and the Chevy Chase area, Chainbridge Road area, if you're familiar with that. What that looks like now, in these areas that became built up, you know, when they were then first developed by developers in the 20th century, were then covered with racially restrictive deed covenants, and these are areas where Black people lived, and the largest community over there being the Reno community, where there were around 370 families living. you know, for the probably, well, the Black community dates all the way to the Civil War, but more Black people had bought houses there in you know, the early 1900s. And by the 1930s, you had a quite large community with two churches, cemetery, civic organizations. And that whole community was raised so that Fort Reno Park could be created and Deal Junior High School could be created to serve this growing white only subdivision of Chevy Chase.
Wow. I mean, it's an extraordinarily tragic history, I think we can say. Just taking a step back, just looking at, you know, we're talking about wealth. When we're talking about home ownership, I, for example, you know, had virtually no wealth until I bought a house, and now, you know, I've got some "quote unquote" wealth through home ownership, and this is something where so many people of color could not get mortgages. I mean, it's rather extraordinary, and the impact in the district, I think, is perhaps best expressed with the ratio of wealth between whites and African Americans, 80-1 in the district. Do I have that right? I mean, it's just extraordinary.
Yeah, it's in the district, in the metropolitan area. It's white households have 81 times the wealth of Black households.
I mean, that is a wild figure. That I think most people are not aware of, and it very much, I think, relates to home ownership.
Certainly does, and so when you have these communities of people that owned land, you know, that owned their homes, not only there at Reno, but at if your Lafayette Elementary School is on Broad Branch Road. That was another very long-standing community consisting of two you know, extended families that owned that land, that also at the very same time were also had their land taken for the construction of Lafayette Elementary School and the recreation center and the park that stand there today. And certainly if those families had been able to hold on to their land, we know that those that area is, those home prices are very, very high today.
Yeah,
that would have made a huge difference for those families and their descendants.
We're going to take a very short break. Speaking with historian, D.C. historian Sarah Schoenfeld, we will be right back with you. Hold tight. And we are in fundraising mode, and we could really use your support, folks. This is the last week of fundraising, and we do need you to step up and show the love. 202-588-9739. You can go online, wpfwfm.org. There's a PayPal option on our website. We have a $600 goal. We're nowhere near reaching it. Please show the love. Please step up. We think we are an important resource, and I think you'll agree, Ms. Valencia. What do you think?
Absolutely, we're a great resource. We're Jazz and Justice here at WPFW-FM, and we need your support. We have to move to another office, and you know, moving is expensive, and we need to, you know, like so many organizations, kind of downsize a bit and find a place that's going to be a really good fit for our team and the community. And we just need your support. It is community building radio. And that means that we need our community to help us keep it going and support it. Much of what we do is volunteer driven. And we want to bring good programming, solid programming, things that are going to, you know, educate and edify you. We cover world events, we cover local politics. And so we want to continue to bring this great programming to you. Please join us today at WPFWFM.org/donate, and you get prompted through there. We are asking you to become a sustainer if possible. You know, a small donation each month in your budget is much more, I think, manageable. And it's good for us on our end, too, in terms of accounting and things. And so I guess it would be very much appreciated to become a sustainer. To support WPFW. And you can call 202-588-9739 is another way to reach it.
202-588-9739. Yeah. Or you can go online, WPFWFM.org. And as I said, there's a PayPal option there. And sustainers are more than welcome. We really appreciate knowing that we have, you know, monthly support going forward. But for $50, you can get a pair of tickets to Letters to Kamala, Dandelion Peace, directed by our first guest, Miss Robinson, Lorraine Robinson. Or for $50, you can get a Taste of Shaw Food and History Tour. And while supplies last, for $75, you can get both the play tickets, a pair of tickets, and a pair of tickets to a Taste of Shaw Food and History Tour. We need you to step up, folks. We're not cracking our $600 goal. We need you to show the love. 202-588-9739 or WPFWFM.org. Please contribute to the wonderful community resource that is WPFW. I'm back with D.C. historian Sarah Schoenfeld. So great having you. I think it's really important to understand this whole redlining phenomena that is displayed at the Cleveland Park Library. The exhibit is called Undesign of the Red Line. It's a traveling exhibit which gets input from each of the community that it visits, and it has a timeline that shows how these redlining maps paved the way for urban decay and white flight in the 60s and 70s, mass incarceration in the 80s and 90s, the foreclosure crisis of the 2000s, and gentrification of today. Sarah Schoffel, if you could talk about all of that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to talk about
nothing to it. I just gave you yeah, five. Right.
I'm not going to talk about all of that, but I will say that, yeah, those are some of the major topics addressed by the exhibit. Certainly the idea that this history paved the way to gentrification, I think, is important to understand in that the sort of artificial overvaluing of property based on who lived in it or who lived in a neighborhood made certain neighborhoods more valuable than others simply based on the race of the occupants. So you had, you know, this is again going back to racially restrictive deed covenants, just, you know, saying there in the deed you could never sell this home to a person of color. It was a way of creating value, of saying this neighborhood is going to be exclusive and therefore your property values are going to go up. And this is something that stuck. So you have then this artificial overvaluing of places that are exclusively white, and a corresponding undervaluing and disinvestment in Black neighborhoods. And this is what creates the conditions for gentrification, and that these areas that are have experienced disinvestment for so long become, you know, quite affordable to people with capital, quite profitable to buy property in, and resell it. The city has done a lot to sort of incentivize not just individuals with capital, but companies to buy up places, to buy up land and to buy a property in areas like Shaw, for example, and what's now known as NoMa, some of our most what have become our most gentrified areas, and that's that is a product of longstanding disinvestment in those areas.
Yep. So. There's a whole series of workshops and talks, I believe, coming out of this exhibit. If you could just touch on that and maybe tell folks how they can find more information about the exhibit online.
Yes. So the exhibit is online at undesigndc.org. And you'll see if you go there, there's a series of programs. The exhibit is going to be up until July 11th. Just a couple of the upcoming programs that I'd like to shout out. On Thursday, June 13th at 6 o'clock p.m. is a program called The Black Broadbench Story. And that is going to be to feature descendants of the community whose family lived on Broadbench Road at the site of what is now Lafayette Elementary School and Recreation Center. They're going to talk about their family's history and the impact of the taking of that land on their families. And I want to shout out my own program on, and again, that program, Black Broad Branch, is on Thursday, June 13th at 6 o'clock p.m. It's free. All of the programs are free. I'm giving another program on Tuesday, July 2nd at 6:30 p.m. On mapping segregation in D.C., racial covenants in Northwest and Southeast. So I'm going to be talking about the project, the work that I've been doing with my colleague Mara Cherkasky since 2014 to map the historic presence of racial covenants all over the city, and talk about some of the work that we are still doing and recruiting volunteers to help us with mapping covenants, specifically filling out some of the areas that we haven't yet fully mapped in Northwest and east of the river, east of the Anacostia River. So that's going to be on Tuesday, July 2nd at 6:30. And again, if you go to undesigndc.org, all of the and go to the programs link, you'll find the programs listed there, and they're all free.
Wonderful. You are such an important resource for folks living in D.C. We thank you for all you're doing. Just to give folks a taste of what else Sarah's working on. You're involved with the exhibit that what is ongoing at Martin Luther King Library. Talk about Up From the People, if you would.
Yes, that is such a great exhibit that everybody should go see. I had the opportunity to be involved in sort of shaping some of the stories that are told there, and some of the research and the writing that's for it's a permanent exhibit at Martin Luther King Library on the fourth floor. There's two exhibits, and the one I'm talking about, Up From the People, Protest and Change in D.C., is it's about the relationship of Martin Luther King and the national civil rights movement to local organizing, and looking at the influences of what was happening here in D.C. Locally on King and on the larger civil rights movement, and vice versa. So those interactions. For example, King came here in 1965 and did a tour all over the city on behalf of the home rule, demanding home rule. He spoke at local elementary schools, local places. So this is, it's really worth seeing, and it shouts out a lot of really important local organizers that you might not know enough about, like Julius Hobson, Etta Mae Horn, lots of really really good DC organizing history. And it is, so check it out.
Check it out. We're going to have to end it there. Really appreciate all you're doing. Appreciate you joining us. I've been speaking with D.C. historian Sarah Schoenfeld, who contributed to the Undesign, the Red Line exhibit, running into July at the Cleveland Park Library. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Really? And I'm definitely a sustaining supporter, and urge you all to support WPFW.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Take care. And we are at the end of our show, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask for your support. We are not getting it, folks, and we really could use your help. Please contribute whatever you can. I know a lot of people are stretched, but we here at Community Radio WPFW are asking for your support. I think we have earned it. We are providing music that you cannot get anywhere else, and we need you to show the love. We are providing, I think, important information with programs like ours. You just heard about a play, two plays, a double bill unfolding that are happening at near DuPont Circle, and I just heard information about the exhibit at Cleveland Park Library. It's relevant. It's important. It's important to understand what's going on culturally here, and what's going on in terms of housing and how it relates to so many important items like wealth. What do you think, Ray? We got a minute left.
Absolutely. Now is the time. Time is running out, everyone. It's time to become a part of Community Radio. We are community building radio. We need your support in order for us to be able to move and set up an office in a new space and continue our great programming. And we really appreciate your support last week, and we would really love it if you can participate this week. And the clock is ticking. Please come to WPFWFM.org to make that sustaining donation. Thank you so much.
202-588-9739, or go online, WPFWFM.org. We've got PayPal there. We're nowhere near fulfilling our goal. We need your help. Please show the love. Please step up. Make the call that makes a difference, or go online and make the donation that makes the difference to WPFW in this program. That's going to do it for our show. Thanks to the amazing Mike Nasella for his engineering expertise. Coming up, the WPFW news headlines, followed by the extraordinary Don't Forget the Blues with the wonderful Lady Murr, bringing you wonderful blues. Love to hear your comments. Please get in touch with me if you have any thoughts, suggestions, program ideas, whatever. DRABIN, DRABIN 902 at gmail.com. www.dbpfw.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dave Rabin, joined by my beloved co-host Ray Valencia. Stay safe and have a good week and take care.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Tuesday, May 28th. Here are some news headlines. Closing arguments have begun in Donald Trump's New York hush money trial. The arguments are expected to last the entire day and give prosecutors and Trump's defense one last chance to address the jury. After that, jurors will get instructions from New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan and begin deliberations. Only a unanimous verdict can convict Trump. The defense is up first and began with Trump's lead lawyer, Todd Blanche, stating, quote, "He did not commit any crimes and the district attorney has not met the burden of proof, period," close quote. As expected, Blanche then told the jurors that they cannot convict the former president based on what he called lies they heard from Michael Cohen, who was the prosecution's key witness. In other news, the death toll from a series of severe storms and tornadoes that hit multiple states across the central and southern United States over the weekend has risen to at least 23. Many of the deaths reported occurred in Cook County, Texas, where two young children were among at least seven people killed in a tornado. Meanwhile, an early season heat wave is already breaking records in parts of southern Florida. According to the National Weather Service, Miami reached a high of 96 degrees on Sunday, beating the previous record of 94 set in 1949. Parts of southern Texas reached temperatures over 100 degrees on Monday. In international news, global outrage is mounting over Israel's airstrike on a camp for displaced Palestinians in Rafah that killed at least 45 people and wounded 200 others. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the strike a tragic error, but reaffirmed that he would not end the war in Gaza until his military's goals were accomplished. Today, journalists on the ground and witnesses say Israeli tanks advanced to the center of Rafah for the first time as Israel enters the third week of its ground operation in the southern Gaza city. The airstrike came 2 days after the International Court of Justice, the UN's top court, ordered Israel to end its military offensive in Rafah, where more than half of Gaza's population had sought shelter. Around 1 million people have now fled the city, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said today. And a growing number of Democrats in Congress are pushing back against House Speaker Mike Johnson's invitation to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress. Johnson announced the invitation last week while saying he was working with Netanyahu on a date. Among those opposing the move is Senator Bernie Sanders, who said he would boycott an address by Netanyahu to Congress, calling it a terrible idea. Many more progressive lawmakers have already told Axios that they would boycott the address as well. Johnson told reporters that Senate Majority Schumer had privately indicated to him that he plans to sign off on the invite, though the Democratic leader has only confirmed publicly that he is in talks with the Speaker's office on the matter. And in weather today in Washington, it is 78 degrees and sunny. Temperatures are forecast to rise to 81 before the end of the day. Thunderstorms and temperatures in the mid-70s are forecast for tomorrow. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.